Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, welcome to the 418th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patron Hamilton Henson, and you can check out Hamilton's work at hamiltonhenson.com, and Kelsey Johnson. Check out Kelsey's Instagram at Kelso Paradiso. I'm Matt Enlow.
And I'm Warren Kaplan, and today we have producer, showrunner, and director Eddie Schmidt on the podcast. He has a new show called Good One, a show about jokes. It's an adaptation of the Jesse David Fox podcast, which Matt has endorsed before, where every episode analyzes a joke from a famous comedian and goes through the creative process. And the show is the same thing, but blown out in a visual medium. So the episode of Good One that we've seen features Mike Birbiglia working on his next show, delving into his creative process, how he comes up with what his shows are about, how he comes up with jokes, how he minds his own life for things. It's really awesome. It's out and it's on Peacock right now, so you could watch it. Good One, a show about jokes with Mike Birbiglia. And Eddie's here to tell us about how it came to be, how he pitched the show, sold the show, got the job, made the show, shot the show. We got it. We delved into his creative process about his show about creative processes, a joke I probably make again later in this episode, but it's true. Okay. It's just, I'm just trying to be authentic here.
We are really navel gazing on this one. We're talking about a show about a show about a show
based on a podcast
That's true. But boy, did I like this conversation.
What are some of his other credits? He's made some other cool things.
My favorites, Ugly Delicious. He did a movie back in the day called This Film Is Not Yet Rated. He did Chelsea Does.
He did In Search Of, which was a remake of a show that I think was made with Leonard Nimoy, but they remade it with Zachary Quinto, right? The original Spock versus the new Spock.
I believe so.
And he worked on Catfish, the MTV show, which is a show about getting catfished, which is so cool.
Yeah, we've had a lot of documentarians on the show over the years, but not that many of them kind of in this niche of funny, comedic documentaries. And so it was a unique lens to have a conversation through, mixing metaphors. But hey, it's that sweet spot of like Oren, you and I relating to him, understanding his process kind of on an innate level as nerds who like jokes. But then also digging in on what it takes to be a fly on the wall, or how to get the funniest things out of inherently funny people. We talk a lot about what his techniques for empowering his subjects to be as great as they can be. And I really loved it. It was really, really great.
Yeah. Even though he does a lot of comedy documentaries, it's clear that he's not going just for the jokes, because Eddie really does know his Schmidt.
Well, on that note,
Let's tell everyone about our Patreon. We have a patreon.com/justshootapod is a URL that you can go to if you want to support us. Get more bad jokes from yours truly, more grimaces and sighs and just disappointing exhalations from Matt Enlow. If you want to support that, if you want to put more of that out into the world, go to patreon.com/justshootapod. Also, you'll get to go to our live shows for free, which we just had our second live show. Episode aired last week. It was such a delight. We're going to do more. Hey, you know what? Feel free to email us at justshootapod@gmail.com to pitch us some ideas for live shows. You want us to get a bunch of failed actors with a bunch of wealthy tycoons we'll do it. Any combination you can think of, we're down for it. You can also just DM us on Instagram at Just Shoot a Pod, or you know, send us a message with your patronage at patreon.com/justshootapod, and we will be sure to reply. So that's it. Should we talk to Eddie?
Let's hop in with Eddie.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, how's it going? We are here with Eddie Schmidt. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah, welcome. Normally when we get pitches from people, we kind of like, you scan people's resumes. You're like, oh, I wonder, like, what's my favorite thing? And you've done a lot of awesome work. But I'll admit, the Thank thing you. That I was like, oh, cool, I'd love to talk to this guy, is this film is not yet rated. I fucking love that movie, man. It's really good. Really good.
Thank you. I mean, you know, that movie has a lot of my DNA in it. And it was something that we really, a story we wanted to tell, and a story we wanted to tell with humor and guts. And I think we were able to do that. And when we made it, I thought, this is the movie that most represents like the sort of 18-year-old me, or the 18, you know, and sure. I still look back on it and think, okay, yeah, I feel good when I watch this irreverent investigation.
It seems like a lot of your work is kind of about the creative process of people.
I think so. I mean, I'm interested in a lot of times the story behind the story. So like in the case of this film is not yet rated, it's like, how do movies get rated? Who's rating them? What's the criteria? And so that's something that I think if you're a fan of movies, you always wonder about. So we kind of wanted to, you know, pull back the curtain on that. And I think in Good One, it's like, where do comedians get their material? How do they pull it together? You know, those sort of questions. And I guess, yeah, you could probably translate that to a lot of things that I've done.
Yeah. Cause I mean, you think about A Good One, and Matt has actually mentioned A Good One, the podcast, as one of his unpaid endorsements in the past.
Yeah.
And I started listening to it based off that recommendation. And it's, you know, our podcast, it's like, some might say it's niche, you know, really delve deep into the craft and like the business of filmmaking. And so ostensibly, if you're not a filmmaker, you might not be that interested in what we're talking about. But I feel like you kind of have done that with A Good One, with This Film Is Not Yet Rated, even with Ugly Delicious or something, where you're kind of delving into like the thought behind the food prep and stuff. Like, we're curious. We've been doing this podcast for 9 years. So there's been obviously talks where we're like, how do we turn this into a TV show? Or would anyone be remotely interested about what we're talking about that goes beyond like a DVD behind the scenes featurette? So I guess I'm curious, like, what your approach is when you land on a topic. How do you figure out if you can make it interesting to like an audience beyond you?
Well, I guess I always think like I am the audience in a way. Like, I feel like the audience is curious and the audience wants to be entertained. I think that I'm both as well. And so, yeah, I guess I always feel like you have to make things, you know, tangible, right? Or like something that you can grab onto. And particularly if you're adapting a podcast, I think it's something you want to take out of the verbal and into the visual in some way, tactile or something. And so certainly with Good One, you know, I think Mike Birbiglia, you know, the comedian that we're following in this docu-special, his process as a comic involves, you know, handwriting, you know, on note cards, multicolored note cards, and each bit or joke, you know, has its own card, and the cards are arranged into an order to present an arc. And so that's something that you can really key into. And it's something that you know, is colorful, literally colorful. And he also, even prior to that, he sort of begins his process writing by hand in journals. And again, that's something that very tactile, very, you know, it's handmade. And so I just felt like those were things that people could grab onto. And for that, like, you know, there was a book that it's over there somewhere called Songs in the Rough. It was all like the original lyrics or music from famous songs. So like, here's Penny Lane on like a piece of notebook paper with coffee stains and stuff. And I was like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if that was, you know, a comedian's routine, you know, with crossed out and all this stuff. So I always had thought in those terms, I guess. And I think even a music documentary, Morgan Neville and I made a film called Troubadours. And I just remember, you know, I also shot a second camera on a lot of that. And James Taylor and Carole King were performing intimately in this coffee house. And I was so close with my lens to watch. James Taylor is an incredible guitar player. And what he was doing on the frets, I play guitar and I was just fascinated. So I wanted to get as close as I could. And I just thought, well, if I can do that, you won't just hear the music, you'll really feel the music and go, wow, that guy is amazing. And so I guess I'm always looking for those kind of avenues in these sort of story behind the story or process-based things. Same thing, Ugly Delicious. Like, I want you to eat that food and want to figure out, you know, how it was made and just, you know, oh, that looks so crispy, I want to taste it, you know?
Yeah. I wonder if you could go, like, document the writing of Game of Thrones with like David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, and they have their note cards and their whiteboards and their writers' rooms, and you're intercutting scenes from the show or something. Like, is it a formula to make that can make things interesting just by the nature of the fact that it's these people making interesting things, or is it like you have a Mike Birbiglia that is on his own just so fun to watch, you know, and you're intercutting like all his jokes and seeing them evolve over time and stuff?
Well, yeah, Mike is a pro and is a really fascinating guy because he's both a very funny person, very joke focused, and a very serious thinker and very sort of story and theme focused. So he is pretty unique, I think. But I do believe that the minutiae and detail of a lot of process, particularly if you're like looking at it, I guess I always think of the camera as like, that's my way to guide, you know, kind of your viewing of it. So I want you to pick up on the details. And, you know, I shoot a lot on prime lenses and things like that because I feel like that's going to give you an isolated experience where, you know, I don't always want the background to be in total focus. I want to direct your attention to something and maybe even have it be a little bit dreamlike where the background is really not in focus because I really only want you to pay attention to what's in the foreground and have this sort of emotional experience with it.
I have so many questions. I'm so excited. but to go with the nerdiest one first, you mentioned the prime lenses, but you know, we're talking about documentary that are oftentimes traditionally when you're a fly on the wall, you're, you know, living in a Zoom so that you can kind of pick things off and, you know, be a little bit more opportunistic. Are you on primes outside of the talking head or kind of more controlled environments? Are you in primes in the verite moments as well?
Yeah, a lot of the time I am. It really depends. I mean, sometimes you're so far away from the subject that you have to be on a Zoom because the distance, I just shot something in the fall where it was not possible. But I still wanted to get close. So that meant I had like a 70 to 200 lens. So I could still get, you know, a tighter shot, but, you know, Zooms, you know, in like in the live show, when we shot the live show, I think I had Mike's live shows. I think I had a mix. I think I had a Zoom on one camera and prime. Yes. I had a Zoom on one camera and primes on the other, the Zoom to be able to get different masters. Right. And then the prime to go in to get the shots that I really wanted, which we use a lot of, which is sort of tight profile shots and also like low angle shots where you kind of saw like the spotlights from the stage. And it's sometimes it's interesting. I almost want to see air. It's hard to describe, but I think when you see like particles and it's not perfect, and you see the, you know, the light from the spotlights, and you can, like, it's almost like what it feels like to be in the audience, for example. And so I would vary it up. And I think because I was unencumbered from having to shoot an entire stand-up show, I could shoot stand-up the way you don't usually see it, because I didn't have to worry, like, I've got to protect every joke. I knew there were jokes that were more apropos to our themes. And so for those, I wanted to play it a little more safe. So I would kind of choose and stick with it. But sometimes when we weren't, I would just play around and kind of see what I got, see if I could get a shot that moved from him as he was shuffling his cards, then drift to the audience, or something like this, where, like, maybe if I needed a full 60 minutes of stand-up, I couldn't go for that shot because I would blow it, you know, coming back or something. So it's a mix. So I do like to shoot on primes. I don't mind taking the time to change a lens if we need to. It's cool. I think it kind of puts everybody at ease. Like, we're not, it's all right. Just we're chilling, and it happens. But sometimes, yeah, it'll depend. But I think I do find that primes have a beauty to them and an immediacy that I do really love.
And do you find that, like, obviously, I think now you're mostly talking about Good One, but do you find that for each docu project that you work on, you kind of develop this, like, visual language first, and then you go and attack the documentary with that language? Or do you kind of discover it while you're making the show?
That's a great question. I think I always say I don't take on a project that I can't visualize, even if I'm not directing it. I have to be able to see it in my head just as a filmmaker. And so I think it usually goes hand in hand. And I remember like when I did Chelsea Does with Chelsea Handler, she's such a great reactor. I just felt like I always have to have a camera on her. I just felt like we're really seeing it through her eyes. Sometimes she could make you laugh just by raising an eyebrow or, like, mm-hmm. you know, an expression. And I thought, I never want to miss that. So I'm always going to have a camera on her. With Ugly Delicious, we kind of went in and said, well, this is anti-chef's table. You know, we want mm-hmm. it, if it's beauty in the raw. We want it to be kind of punk rock. And so we knew that going in. And with this too, I thought, oh, I want to see stand-up, you know, kind of the way that we're not used to seeing stand-up. We used to seeing it in a very slick way. And I knew that I wanted the jokes to land, but I also wanted you to feel like you were in the room somehow, however mm-hmm. I could deliver that. And I guess I also, yeah, I wanted you to feel like you were privileged to be there. There's scenes in sort of Mike's dressing room in Providence where we really are in the doorway, but I wanted to show the doorway mm-hmm. and the sense that we were finding them, which we were, because we didn't want to be in the room. We felt like we were lucky to be there. It was truly the seat that we had. And I thought that actually said something, like, hey, we're just here picking off stuff because we don't want to ruin their vibe in there, you know? And so then that's a certain thing that gets delivered to that, which is authentic.
Yeah. It brings to mind, a kind of big question I always have about, quote unquote, comedic or funny documentaries, right? Because, you know, over the years, it's felt like, you know, a true crime documentary, we all have a mental image of what that's supposed to look like. And those are becoming more and more, quote unquote, cinematic, right? Like, the talking heads feel moody, the recreations feel very, you know, in the moment and stylized and all that. And historically, I think that, like, the more off the cuff or comedic, you know, documentaries didn't lean into style as much. But yours, I think Ugly Delicious even is a great example. That's like a funny food show with a lot of style to it. Do you feel like, beyond just the sense of trying to visualize things, what draws you to that sort of contrast in tone? Is it important for it to look good, or do you just let the jokes do their thing?
No, I think it is important to look good. For me, I mean, I'm trying to make it look like the world that I feel like when I'm in it, or that I want people to feel like when they're in it. So I think in Good One, just naturally, you know, there's a red curtain in Providence that he's in front of, and there's a warmth. I wanted warmth, you know, and mm-hmm. he's in that dressing room downstairs, and it has this, I think it's like there's oranges and aquas, but again, it's warm. And I think in Ugly Delicious, we played around with different color temperatures. Sometimes we purposely went cool to be jarring, other times, but it was, we still wanted the food to look good, you know, but the food was messier. You know, he's eating a dumpling, it's exploding, and it wasn't precious or fancy, but at the same time, it was soulful, right? Mm-hmm. And so I do think about a lot about color temperature and about what are the lens choices and the palette going to give you as a, in an emotional way. And like, so when I did In Search Of, when we brought rebooted In Search Of with Zach Quinto, current Spock, and took him out of narrating over clips like did in the 70s and sent him off to do these adventures, I used a lot of blues and greens and things that were more like sci-fi or Fincher or things, because it was meant to be eerie and meant to be this sort of nexus between science and science fiction. And so that to have a warm color palette didn't make any sense. It wasn't just about being pretty. So I guess to answer your question, the heart of it, it's like, I do like when things look quote unquote good, but good is relative to the feeling that you're meant to convey. And so, you know, I do personally gravitate toward like warm colors and things like that. And I think particularly for things that are meant to be comedic, but also have some heart, I think that that is the natural place that I gravitate towards. But I wouldn't impose that on something where the subject matter, you know, didn't call for that, or it wasn't meant to evoke that feeling. And by the way, this is something that's evolved, right? I mean, I think you mentioned this film is not yet rated. I shot a lot of that myself. I shot all the PI material, really. I was in the back of the car with the private investigator. And at that point, I'm just thinking, I just got to get the shot. Like, if we think we see a raider on the freeway and she spotted them, I just have to nail that. I can't really be thinking too much about how good it looks. And I don't think I wasn't as sophisticated to even be really capable at that point. It was really about like, I know the framing I want, and I know that I want it exposed properly, but I didn't have all the tools, and I didn't have the kind of crews that I work with. Like, we were working with much smaller crews then.
Sure.
How big is the crew on like a good one on this last show?
I want to say it's like 12 to 14, something like that. But that's, you know, that means though that like, that's so you can load in and load out and that you're able to get, you know, get gear and move from location to location and, you know, people driving cars and,
And you guys are like pre-lighting all these locations like before?
A little bit. You just go in and you're like, okay, we're going to be in this room. Mm-hmm. What is, you know, oh, it's a overhead light. You know, we're just going to be shattered on people. Can we quickly put, you know, how practical, like sometimes mm-hmm. it's just a practical, like, can we just bring in a lamp or something? Or can, you know, whatever you could do, mostly because you're just like, wow, a lot of times in spaces that you're entering, it's just like fluorescents or something that are going to flicker or that are going to just look unflattering. So you're thinking, okay, if I get a chance to go in here, what could I do? But sometimes not at all. I mean, when talking about Goodwin, we were filming in Mike's old neighborhood where he grew up. We didn't know that we could get into the old house until we were there and the homeowner said, do you want to come in? I don't have time to. Yes. Sure. I didn't have time to light anything. We just went in, you know? So you kind of respond to the elements, you know, hopefully you're thinking, oh, I want to try to get a little bit of time to get in there just so that I don't lose people's faces or expressions, or it's really unflattering, or like I said, like flickering lights. But mostly you're trying to just make it, keep it natural so that when people are in the space, there aren't lights, they're not worried about where they land, they can have an authentic experience, but you've already thought like, okay, I cleared it and I know that I can shoot this and it's not going to look like soup. You know, right.
Well, while you're shooting, are you like, Mike, can you take a step to your left? And you turn around, can you open the camera? Like, are you throwing out little directions?
No, I try not to. I try to really actually keep, and back to your question about crew, keep as few people, cameras and sound in the room, mm-hmm. and everybody else out of the room. And if I can, I'm usually out of the room myself with monitors, and I'm talking on a headset to the cameras, and I really just want things to unfold and conversation to happen. Mm-hmm. And sometimes somebody might say something and it gets stepped on, or it's fascinating, but the conversation moves away from it. And so when the conversation peters out, you know, I step back in the room and go, could you go back? You mentioned that thing, and mm-hmm. then you guys dropped it. Can you just talk about that a little more? And then I run away. Like, I want to make sure that everything that they want to say in a space or to each other, that they're able to do that and feel comfortable and not rushed, and that they're not forgetting things, or people talk over each other and something gets lost. And so I'm thinking, oh, that was fascinating. That maybe if I'm lucky, they'll go back and talk about that again. But yeah, I don't want to be in anybody's eye. I don't want them to be thinking about me. I want them to be thinking about each other. You know.
Interesting. And are you are you worried about the 180 degree line? Like, you know, like trying to be over people, like shooting the whole scene, the wide shot from one angle and the overs, like kind of on the correct side of the.
I am. And I'm also will throw it out if it means that somebody walked in from the other room and said something amazing, or they changed where they're sitting. Sometimes you're like, oh, I want that. I hope that person will sit there, or, you know, or you and then they don't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, or yeah. So yeah, I'm very cognizant of that. You know, I went to Vassar. I studied film. I made narrative films before I ever made documentaries, and very much a student of film. So all those things are in my head, but I also, if somebody's doing something or saying something, you know, amazing or emotional, it's like you have to just throw that out and go,
who cares?
It's okay. Yeah. Who cares?
Yeah. Sure. But you would think in like docu, and you came from, you did some like unscripted stuff, right? I saw you worked on Blind Date back in the day.
Yeah. Well, that came from my comedy background initially. And I was hired to write the joke bubbles. I was in a room with a lot of funny people. We each would sit with like a VHS TV monitor with headphones, and we each had a date, and you'd have like, you know, 12 funny people in a room, each working on their own date.
I have another question about directing comedy docs. It's very different than Matt's question, which is, you know, you worked with some very funny people. You mentioned Chelsea Handler, obviously Mike Birbiglia. You worked with Gilbert Gottfried, a bunch of very funny people. Do you ever feel pressure as the director to be funny?
Oh, to be funny? Yeah.
Like, do you ever walk in, you're like a little nervous that like they're not laughing at your jokes? Or like, I do that when I work with I work in comedy mostly, not documentary, but I'm always like worried that people will not think I'm funny, and I'm trying to direct funny things, you know?
Why would you think about that for?
Right. Well, I think that my job is to bring out the funny in them. Do you know what mm-hmm. I mean? So like, mm-hmm. I guess I'm more thinking like, and you know, and that I have comedy background. I do come from sketch, and so I believe in that, you know, you're trying to help the other person score. So I'm thinking like, well, I'm not on camera. It's not about me. It's about making you comfortable invisibly so that you'll do your best work and be as funny as the funny version of you that I love, because I'm there mm-hmm. because I appreciate them. And so, yeah, I don't think too much. I mean, you know what, if you throw out something and they don't love it, that never feels great. But sure. But I think usually, yeah, it's really, again, it would just be like if I threw something out because I thought they could run with it. And if they don't want to run with it, I don't care. But if they want to run with it and it helps them.
Mm-hmm. You're high up it all day.
Yeah, right. You are high it off it all day. But yeah, it's not really about, oh, can I score?
Sure.
It's really about can they score?
Yeah.
But it sounds like you're not really manufacturing funny moments anyway. You're more like mining them for like they naturally do the comedy, but you're kind of mining them for like truth.
Yes. I mean, I think it's a little bit different. Like obviously the Chelsea does documentaries were meant to be comedic documentaries. It was like taking her into situations. And so we knew that she was going to have fun with them. But what was cool is like, we didn't know, you know, I would think, oh, I can't, you know, we found this, whatever, doctor or scientist for her to speak to. I think they're really going to piss her off, or they're really, or she's really going to be delighted by them. I don't know what's going to happen. You know, it's sort of about what's combustible at that point. But certainly if something is awkward or, you know, uncomfortable, or somebody is not telling the truth or being, and, you know, then her job is to sort of puncture that truth in a comedic way. But I think with the, with Good One, you know, Mike, and I was very conscious of this. I was like, well, I want the stand-up, you know, you should be laughing at the stand-up, you know, he's very funny, and he's also funny in life, but there's also many points where he's just serious and just, you know, talking to his family. And, and so that's just his process. There was no sort of like, oh, how can I get him to be funny? I wasn't thinking that. I was just thinking, can I get him to be open about his process and to be open about where he's at in his head or emotionally with the people that he knows well or is around, you know?
You know, in talking about like, you know, Chelsea Does or Ugly Delicious with David Chang or Good One, you know, those are like very distinct voices, right? Is there anything like that you do differently from person to person, you know, like how do you shift gears between beyond just like making them feel like, you know, they can be their best selves and putting them in the right scenario? Like, is there anything else you think about, you know?
Yeah, I guess I think about their personalities, you know. I mean, like, Chelsea, you know, is like a no BS, like wants to like, let's get in there, let's do it, and I'm having a good time, and we've kind of exhausted, and then we're done. Like, so I wouldn't sort of be like, oh, could we try this? What if you ask this question? Or like, you know, I need like, another
I think we got it. I think we got it, Eddie.
And I'd be like, okay, but I need this one close-up of your hand or whatever get or something. Sure. You pass this piece of paper. But like with In Search of, like, Zach Quinto is, first of all, he's in totally different situations and different topics, but he's really like, you know, he wants to think through things, and he wants to really, so, you know, you could really keep throwing things, you know, you do, you know, an OTF, right? An on the fly interview after shooting a verite scene. And like, you know, you could, he wanted to process it with you. He wasn't sort of like, I did it, I'm done. It's just his own meter, right? It's just his own personality. And so, yeah, I would think very, very much about like, well, what is somebody's temperature, I guess, just, and are they, you know, someone that, you know, whatever, has a lot of patience and wants to kind of pontificate, or are they really like, they come in, they want to just bam, and you know, move on. Like, I want to be reactive to them to create a space that's comfortable for them. And they're all different personalities.
In the case of Mike in particular, you know, he is a lauded filmmaker on his own right, and also a person who very publicly, he's got his own podcast about the creative process, and also his shows are about the creative process. So he's no stranger to the topic at hand. How do you lean into creating? So how do you collaborate with a person like that who has such a clear voice and such a clear handle on the thing that you're trying to do? And does it himself often as well. You know what I mean?
Well, I think a lot of trust. I mean, I think, you know, Mike really wanted to know where I was coming from. And I think I had a, you know, conversation with him very early on and throughout the process where I kind of let him know who I was and like why I was interested in elements of his comedy and his life and what spoke to me about his material and kind of who he was and why we want to, you know, in other words, like, I don't just want to see your journals because I'm hoping I'm going to see something, you know, naughty in them that you never showed anybody. It's like, no. I'm literally want to see process, and I want to see hard work and thought. And the best way to do that, if you're comfortable, is to show us your journals. And he, and you know, as he says to Ira Glass in the piece, you know, I never showed them to anyone before. And then Ira says, what do you mean? You did a whole, you know, one man show called My Secret Public Journals. And he was like, yeah, I talked about him. I never showed him to anybody. So I think the leap there was, he's a storyteller who's used to telling his own story. Can he be comfortable with us telling his story? Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make sure that he was, because again, I think part of, I mean, you know, you can't expect to want to show somebody's process and have them, if they're uncomfortable with you, it's going to show and they're not going to allow you in. And also it's going to be uncomfortable to watch. So I think it was very important that he did trust us and know that there was no gotcha to this. It was really like, hey, you know, we think you're a great comic and you are a really hard craftsman and your elements of your life dovetail with your material in really deep and interesting ways. Can we see all of that? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he was really open to that, but certainly it meant being, you know, the most genuine. And that's the one truism with all these wonderful people that I've worked with. They're all, I think, used to dealing with a certain amount of BS. You know, when you're a famous person, when you're a star, you know, people will just tell you what you want to hear. And I think I try to go out on a limb to be myself and to really tell them what I really think. And, you know, if I really need something or something is important or why I want something. And I think I've always found that people appreciate the directness and the genuineness.
I'm curious, like, a little bit about the business side of things. You have a long resume of a lot of cool things, but how on this show specifically, on Good One, how did you get the job? Like, how does someone like you get the job to direct this show?
I gave myself the job.
Did you help create it?
Yes. Yes, I did. So I had an overall deal with Universal Television. And when that deal was in place.
Can I just go back one step? How do you get an overall deal with Universal Television?
Well, I was fortunate to have a body of work, and I had done In Search Of with them, the reboot of In Search Of, and they were happy with it. And they were kind of really expanding their alternative studio. Mm-hmm. And I think, and they knew that, you know, and they were also making a deal with Chelsea. And I think, and they knew that I had obviously worked with her. And I think they just thought I could help sort of build out their business. And I would imagine that they looked to the kind of things that they often do, which are sort of competition shows and, you know, talent shows and things like that, and thought, oh, we don't really have anybody like me. And so, you know, it's probably, I guess, seemed like a sort of unique, you know, addition to the family. So, yeah, so that meant that I had a nice open door, if you will, to ideas. And that's helpful because then you don't have to, sometimes, you know, when you're on your own, you oftentimes have to do a ton of legwork just to build out an idea that someone may not want to go with, right, at square one. And so that can be daunting. So what was really cool is that because I had that deal, you know, people would bring me things, whether it was a magazine article or a book, or I'd read a book or I'd meet a comic or whatever, and I could sort of, you know, elevator pitch those things. And so...
So you have like a production company.
Yeah, yeah, right.
That has a deal with UCP? With Universal?
With UTAS.
Oh, with
Universal
UTAS, right.
Television Alternative Studio. Yeah, so Scoop Wasserstein, who is a producer who works with Vulture New York Magazine, he and I were talking about something else, as a matter of fact, and he said, you know, would you be interested in adapting the Good One podcast? And I thought, would I? You know, it's sort of it brings together all these different threads of things that I love. And I was a fan of the podcast and still am, and of Jesse's interviewing style. And I thought he was doing something rigorous and unique and adaptable. And so I was able to go.
Did you know him at all, or you were just a fan of the podcast?
I didn't know Jesse. I had been introduced to Scoop, and Scoop and I were talking about a different project that didn't materialize. And in the course of those conversations, he brought up Good One. A light bulb went off, mm-hmm. and I went to Monica Rodman, who was my point executive, so the senior VP of development, and I explained that there was this and I wanted to adapt this podcast and essentially take it from an interview format into a kind of immersive docu experience where the comic takes you mm-hmm. along. And she got very excited about it, you know, without me having to do a whole huge, you know, a deck at that point, mm-hmm. or song and dance. And immediately
tell me more.
And,
Tell me more.
And this was great. And I had their support, and, you know, and Jesse was really on board, and had, I think, and he's talked about this, where he felt like, because we wanted to take a food show approach to comedy, and that was how he looked at what he was doing and how it could translate with Good One. He was excited that I had been showrunner director of Ugly Delicious, and that he thought that I would get it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, anyway, you know, the other crucial piece of the puzzle here is that, you know, because of NBC Universal, you know, the idea was always, well, we need to team our auspices with someone, someone of Seth Meyers and his company, because we need to mint this as being something legitimate, right? Mm-hmm. The something that really understands comedy. And so right away, you know, Seth and his producing team, so Mike Shoemaker and Jason Carden, they really got it. And Jason day to day was, you know, very much, you know, hands-on in sort of in getting this done. And all those guys were super supportive of what this could be and the smartest version of what this could be. And their getting behind it really meant a lot within, you know, Universal, and certainly with Peacock, but also with the comics. It was like, hey, you know, between Jesse and Seth, this is going to be a real deal thing. Don't even worry about me. I'm not going to mess it up. You know,
it's so crazy. I was mentioning to you, sorry to interrupt, but before we started recording, we have a friend that's been on the podcast, Grant, that's also kind of in that space. He has, you know, an overall deal, and he sometimes with ABC, sometimes they bring him ideas that he develops. Sometimes he brings them ideas. And he also, like, you know, just did a show with like Omaha with the, you know, the Manning, Peyton Manning's company. And it's like, it's interesting to see the Hollywood of kind of unscripted TV, like how the pieces come together. Because I think if you ask Matt and me, like, we're big fans of Jesse David Fox and Good One and the podcast and a lot of your past work. And it's like, that seems incredibly legit to us, but it's just interesting that you have to
still
add, like,
the deal with
a comedy celebrity. That's not, I mean, Seth is in the documentary, but he doesn't have to be in the documentary, right?
No,
for it to work.
No, he didn't. No, that was it. Right. That was his choice to be in it. But I think as a producer, it's what a good producer does, which is like, I believe in this. I know how hard it is to get things made. I appreciate other comedy, not just his own comedy. I appreciate he appreciates a range of comedy and different comedy. And so the idea of shining a spotlight on comics and their process and the work involved appealed to him and appealed to his partners. And that is what a good producer could do, because this took still a long time to get made. And mm-hmm. at any point, you know, things can wilt away. And so having a producing partner who is, you know, an amazing comic who understands comic, to whom other comics that you might want to get on the show go, oh, I know I'll be in good hands. I mean, that it's huge. You know, it's really important.
Actually. I mean, I assume also Seth could just pick up the phone and call, you know, Hasan Minhaj and say, like, hey, will you be, you know, in the documentary, or, right? Like there is like a network of mm-hmm. talent that you're tapping into also that way, or is that, am I totally wrong?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, I think, again, you know, I don't know how I could really, it's so complicated how things come together and get put together, but I just think the imprimatur of, like, hey, it's from this podcast and Seth is behind it as our producer is an incredible reassurance of quality to anyone that we might approach.
You know, it's real, right?
You know, it's real. You know, it's real.
It is interesting. We kind of learn that lesson almost on every episode of Just Shoot It. Usually it's in the scripted narrative space where it's like, why can't I attach this person to my thing? And then all of a sudden, you get like CAA, or you get this producer, or you get this talent, and then everything else falls into place. But it's like at some point when someone is getting 100 projects to consider, and one of them is produced by Seth Meyers, that might move that to the top of the pile.
Well, and I always think of things as like, what do they say when you're trying to pitch something? Is it undeniable? Can you make it undeniable? Sure. Right? Is it sort of bulletproof? mostly because most things don't happen, right? Most things, there's so many little things along the way that can stop a project, you know, from happening. It is, yeah, I remember this. When you're making it, you're like, oh, I'm back in the groove. This is how it is. We're making something. And when it's done, you realize, oh, it really is a miracle to make anything. Like, even though I've done it, you know, multiple dozens of times, you're still like, wow, it's amazing that things get made, because so anything can knock it off track. So I think I'm always thinking, what is the way that we can put the pieces together? Not in a cynical way, but like that just makes this like the best version of what it could be. Oh, that makes total sense. I want to make that or watch that, you know, because it just seems, of course that should exist, you know?
Yeah.
I'm curious about the development process a little bit, right? Because, you know, if you start from, hey, we're going to adapt this very popular interview-based, you know, podcast, and then, you know, we look at the end result, there are a lot of, like, that's an undeniable pitch at the very beginning, but there are a lot of big creative decisions that have to happen in between there and the final result, right? Like, for instance, it not being interview-based to start with, right? Like, how did those decisions get made? And also, like, how are you presenting those to people? Who are you pitching? Who are the stakeholders? You mentioned there's no deck at this point. Like, how does it come together and become the show that it is?
Well, eventually then there was a deck, and then, you know, we did pitch the show, and Seth was, by the way, was in those pitches. Seth and his whole team were in those pitches. So he was, again, really committed to it. We were pitching
those
over
pitches
Zoom.
That have like a bunch of people in the room instead of just two.
Well, it's Zoom, you know, so it's like a lot of squares.
Yeah.
But you're building it out. So I mean, I think so. First of all, I had an amazing director of development under my deal at Universal named Lucy Place, who really worked with me the whole time, and is a tremendous sounding board researcher, thinker. And so a lot of it, you know, the decision of Jesse not being on camera, you know, was an early one, and one that I had to really think through and stick to, I suppose, because I just felt in my gut, I just felt like I really want you to feel like you, the audience, are getting to go on this journey, not that you're watching a proxy go, which, you know, and Jesse is an incredibly skilled interviewer and has an incredible rapport with comics. But I just still felt like, I guess I'm thinking again of myself as the audience, and I'm thinking, I want them to be talking to me, just me. I don't really want to think about anybody else that's in between us. And then also, if Jesse is in the show, he has, in my opinion, he has to have an arc. If he doesn't, he's more of a hosty host, and a hosty host is a little bit more like a talk show or a reality show, as opposed to a documentary feel and a more immersive you are there kind of documentary feel. So that's what I was always sort of going for, and I just thought that would be more delightful, and I just wanted the rapport both that I had with Mike and the rapport that Jesse had with Mike to come through the camera. So it came through at the audience, so that they saw a Mike who was, you know, wanted to be there and was, you know, felt like taking you with him. So yeah, so then, you know, we had to sort of build it out and think about, again, all those elements of tangibility and, you know, how do you show how it evolves? How do you show the jokes and the life part coming together, and where that happens? And a lot of it is coming from the subject. It's like, well, Mike is joke. He is an autobiographical comedian, so he is talking about the stuff of life. So then, you know, a lot of it came from like listening to a tremendous amount of Good One podcasts and thinking, oh, I'd like to see that. Oh, that's funny the way someone said that. I wonder if we could visualize that.
What's your favorite Good One, Eddie?
There's so many that I love.
I'm going to tell you one,
and it's just because it's a personal favorite, because it's a personal hero. And that is the one with Weird Al, where Jesse did what I would want to do, which is to get to sit down with Weird Al, and he opens up the computer and pulls up the Word Crimes document, Busan Word Crimes, and is showing all the coulda, woulda, shoulda, maybe, didn't go down this road, ideas I threw out, word choices I changed, things I, you know, fine-tuned for the meter of the song, just all the stuff, all the comedy nerd stuff that you'd want if you loved Weird Al and you wanted to see how his brain worked, you know?
I did not listen to that one, but I'm going to now.
You should.
That's a really good pitch for listening to that episode.
You couldn't have named a better comic for the middle of the three circles of this Venn diagram.
Yeah, that sounds incredible. I know we're running out of time, but I just wanted to ask you about one other thing from your past. You were a co-EP of a show called Catfish on MTV. And I'm just so curious. So for our listeners that don't know that show, it was it was also adapted, right, from a feature film, a documentary about a guy that got catfished, which is when, you know, you
coined the term, basically.
Yeah.
Right.
Somebody is courting you online and then turns out to not really be who they say they are. Wasn't there some docu-series, Matt, that you liked? Where everyone lived in a building and half the people were
circle.
Like, the circle. We're catfishing each other.
That is a reality show.
A reality show, yeah.
That is utter trash, and I love it.
But so you went on to work on a series where every week you had a different catfishing story. Yes. How did you come up? Like it seemed like such a once in a lifetime type of documentary, because this guy is like literally falling in love with someone and slowly realizing that someone is not who they say they are, and kind of getting lucky, I think, right, with the original Catfish documentary. How do you recreate that every week on MTV?
You know, the story's just I think because of creating this forum to explore these things that people would be otherwise, you know, I don't know, embarrassed about or not know even how to go about figuring out, the stories just came. I mean, I think it was interesting because, you know, at the time, I think we were thinking, how long can this go on? And now they're like at their 200th episode, something or more. Like,
it still on?
Clearly, it's still on. Yeah. Yeah.
Are you serious?
It's still going. Yes.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it just speaks to sort of the.
And it's still with Nev?
Neve. It's still with Neve. Not Max. It's different. Different person in Max's shoes. Max is a filmmaker himself and went on to, you know, to make his own films. But yeah, I think it just speaks to our sort of disconnected time and and the sort of, you know, all the guises that you can wear online. But it's amazing that it's still going strong.
You mentioned that so Mike Birbiglia is kind of the first installment of this show. Did you guys have Mike lined up when the show sold, or was he kind of the first person you ended up casting?
I think we felt like, we hope that the people love this and we get to make more. And I think when we looked at sort of our maiden voyage, if you will, we thought, well, who is a comic that is open about process? And as you point out, Mike has a podcast where he has comics on, and he, you know, and he does these shows in between his sort of big one-man shows where he is trying things. So we just naturally felt like if he's into this, if he's into letting us in, this is going to be great. And, you know, he'd been on Good One a few times, and Jesse had written about him, so there was trust there. He and Seth are friends. So again, it felt like, okay, if he's going to take the leap to let anybody else have a window into his process in his life, this seemed like a pretty good crew to do it. And and I think we felt like, well, he's a great partner to come in as our subject to sort of help show what Good One can be. That now you could think, when you watch this, hopefully you're like, oh, well, what if they did it with name your favorite comic, you know? That person is probably on our short list for who's next.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah
That's awesome. Well,
thank you.
If you ever need another podcast to turn into a TV show or a special, like a filmmaking one, where we interview really amazing directors.
Indie Film Hustle is great.
Yeah.
Sorry. No, that's a competing podcast.
Check out Just Shoot It. It's your lucky day that you...
This you was great. I will say it was really a breeze talking to you guys. It went by so fast. I feel like I babbled and I should have just been quiet for more.
No, it was great. It was great.
But it was a pleasure because, and I think, you know, you mentioned this going in, we were sort of setting up as just like, hey, this really is for people who want the information. Mm-hmm. And I think, and that made this conversation so fun because sometimes in other interview settings, certainly shorter interviews or interviews that aren't geared towards people who are, you know, want to be in the industry or just have such a passionate love of it, you find yourself thinking, how do I explain this to people who may not understand it? Yeah, whereas here, I just thought, I don't have to worry about that.
I think part of, to me, the podcast, and especially even like talking to doc filmmakers is, to me, like documentary filmmaking is like the scary version of filmmaking. It's just you do not know what you're going to get as opposed to like making the shot list. And first we're going to do this first and then we're going to do this. And, you know, and I think you might have like a really interesting character or a thematic exploration of something and kind of some arc that you're going for. You're building up to an event or something. But you just never know if it's going to be good or not. And just hearing the people that have done it so well in the past talk about how they also don't know what's going to happen makes everyone feel a little more confident about trying it, you know, and going for it.
Well, that's good. And I think they should, because I think you're right. It didn't hit me until you said this, but it does combine two things that I have done. I was a student filmmaker making films in college, and I did come from, you know, sketch and improv. So I'm used to like, you think and think and think and prepare, and then you go out there and stuff happens.
Sure.
And same thing of like student filmmaking. You're like, well, we're going to try this. Well, it's just us. Maybe we can go grab a shot of that. It might work. You know, there's an experimental part of it and a looseness, you know, hopefully.
And an opportunism that's kind of makes for some of the best accidents, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you have to prepare super well to get into that zone, you know, kind of like the way that performers train, same thing. You're just like, I'm cramming it all in, and then I walk out there and I'm free.
Well, if people want to keep up with what you're doing personally or what your company's doing, are you on social media? Or is there anywhere we can keep track of you?
EddieSchmidt.com. I do have an Instagram. It's private, but, you know, give it a shot. I'm out there and I still have an account on what used to be called Twitter, but I don't really use it very much. I'm around though. On Twitter, it's or X or whatever, it's Eddie_Schmidt. On Instagram, it is Get Schmidt.
So SCHMIDT.
Yes.
For those that are wondering.
That's right. Yes.
EddieSchmidt.com. Pretty cool website.
Well, Eddie, do you have a few more minutes to hang out and endorse with us?
Oh, are you kidding? Talk about other people's stuff? Please.
Unpaid endorsements.
I'll start off with two unpaid endorsements. This whole episode, I was thinking to myself, dang, I've gone through all of my favorite, like, fun, quirky documentary references. Like, we've been doing this show for over 400 episodes, so, like, I can't bring up American Movie again or whatever, you know? So I'm going to go with some low-hanging fruit of an episode of Ugly Delicious that I really, really cherish. You were the producer on all of them. We get to lump you in with, you can take credit for this a little bit, but the tacos episode of Ugly Delicious is one that I really love. As an Angelino, you know, it's the one where it's David Chang and Gustavo Arellano and Jonathan Gold, like, just rolling around at different taco spots. And it is so fun and so LA and shot so well. That's the one, like, it's one where they put the car mount at the very end of the hood. You know, it's like where the hood emblem would be. So you get just, and it's a nice big wide angle. You see the cities behind them. They're like kind of tiny in the middle of the frame. And it's just such a great vibe and so fun. And I really love tacos. So,
yeah.
It's near
you and dragons.
Oh. Yeah.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, I was the showrunner for that. And so, yeah, I was riding behind them, actually. We were riding behind them.
I think we see you in a couple shots.
You might.
So that's my first endorsement. And then my next one is embarrassing and very middle-aged, but here we go. The X-Men cartoon, X-Men 97, is rolling out on Disney Plus. Are you guys aware? Are you familiar?
Is that an old cartoon?
It is like an old cartoon, but it is new episodes of the X-Men cartoon from when we were kids, basically. Like, they are just like, hey, dads watch Disney Plus 2. Let's market to them. And it's literally just like, you know, a new run of X-Men cartoons with that same classic lineup, like, of the X-Men from those cartoons. And so it does this thing of, like, scratching that itch of, you know, it would be like if you could see, like, the 93 Bulls play again or something. It's like something deep, deep, deep in my childhood that really ignited a love of comics and a love of storytelling that kind of ultimately, you know, landed me here today. And it's so strange to be able to, like, get new episodes of this thing that I loved dearly but didn't think a ton about in the last 20 years. It's the same theme song. It's like all the themes and ideas and characters that you love are there. And I've unabashedly had a great time. So X-Men 97 is my other endorsement.
That's awesome. I guess that's like you can watch it with your kids.
Honestly, it's a little too violent.
Matt has a 2-year-old.
I have a 2-year-old. That's true. It's also like, I think they'd just be bored by it. Honestly, it's for old people. You know, like, okay. No, they're not excited that Mr. Sinister shows up in episode 3. Like,
right.
So, yeah. Your kids want to watch it with you, great. But for me, it's a guilty pleasure.
Okay, Eddie, what do you got?
Eddie, what you got?
Yeah, I just saw a film. It's an A24 film that's out in theaters called Problemista.
Oh, cool.
Julio Torres.
Yeah,
cool.
I thought it was great. I mean, I just was delighted the whole time. I think so. He wrote it, directed, stars. He created an incredible role for Tilda Swinton, who's just like,
she needs some more good roles.
Oh, yeah, right. She doesn't enough. No, but she just embraces this role as kind of, you know, on the surface, sort of a boss from hell who ends up sort of, you know, I don't want to give anything away, but leads to some surprises for his character. And I found that the movie, it's wildly inventive, very visual, very funny. It's both satirical and whimsical. And it's unusual for a comedian to craft a vehicle where they don't give themselves the showiest role. Really interesting. He gave himself an understated, dreamy role. And he gave Tilda Swinton this, like, really over-the-top comic character. Mm-hmm. It works terrifically. I actually got choked up at the end, which I didn't expect. I'm not going to tell you how or why, but it's about, you know, creativity and artists and the art world and dreaming and inventions. But it's almost as if you took, like, can I make a sort of like chill peewee type of movie now filtered through like a really hip indie A24 sensibility, you know. I felt like it was doing these complicated things that you wouldn't expect could go together and doing them beautifully.
Kaplan, what you got?
So two things. The first thing is this video. I don't know, somehow I happened upon it on YouTube. Both of my endorsements are things that have like a bazillion views and everybody knows about, but I'd never ever heard of them. The first one is, you know, that song Somebody That I Used to Know by Gotye. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'd heard the song, but someone made a dance music video. It's called CDK-Somebody That I Used to Know by Gotye. It's made by this guy named Sergio Reis, R-E-I-S. He's the choreographer and the director. And it's just like, I mean, this is probably one of the most overplayed songs in modern times, but the dancing in this video and the way it's shot, it's like shot in an auditorium of something. You know, sometimes I'll see these like dance videos, I'm like, all I want is a choreographer for my next project. Mm-hmm. Someone that can just put people next to each other and make such beautiful imagery with nothing but people, you know? And I just loved it. And he's a choreographer, so he has all these awesome videos that, you know, I think you could film things like this for pretty inexpensively if you happen to be in a community of amazing dancers and, you know, you get some cool wardrobe. Anyway,
are you saying move to New York is what you're saying?
Yeah. Or LA. Remember I did that shoot last year where I had this brilliant idea. We had a budget for 12 extras, background people to fill up this little party. And I was like, why don't we just cast 12 dancers, you know, to be our background and bring on choreographers and just have fun movement in the background that's rhythmic. It was for a music video that takes place in a party. And so, I don't know, just something I want to try to tap into more in my own work is like choreography. Anyway, my other discovery, so it's this creator. Her name is Savannah Moss, S-A-V-A-N-A-H-M-O-S-S-S, three S's. I discovered her because she made a video with Zach King, you know, the Vine magician, who makes these awesome visual transitional videos. But she makes just, she used to be like a model cheerleader or something. I don't know, but she makes the most bizarrely insane videos. All of them have insane transitions. Every single one of them features her filling up a cup with milk and also doing a spin that ends up with her falling on the ground. And she makes all these videos by herself. She acts in all of them. Her acting is just weird. Have you heard of her before?
I have. Matt? And it's like if you could put David Lynch into a TikToker's body. It's like it's scary and unnerving and technically incredible all at once and like stream of consciousness.
She infuses everything with like dad jokes, which makes me kind of like fall in love with her instantly. Like, you know, she'll
But there's something sinister about them.
Yeah. She's just like, I'm like, who?
Oh, yeah.
What happened in this young woman's life that sent her sense of humor in this direction and her filmmaking skills in the opposite direction? And
I see a little Sarah Sherman.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, but the transitions, you know, I direct a lot of commercials with transitions and I'm always like, oh, okay, what's this going to be? Is it, are we going to spin the camera? Are we going to wipe the camera? And she, just every single one of her transitions is just so bonkers. Like, I'm going to walk into the oven and now all of a sudden I'm falling and getting.
And now I'm a pinata.
Yeah. And I hit the pinata and now I'm a mermaid. Like, just where is this coming from? And she just makes these videos with her sisters. Anyway, for like, you know, assuming very low budgets, and she's randomly always wearing like a Starbucks uniform or a Subway t-shirt or these various brands that are not paying her.
Maybe they should.
Yeah. So anyhow, I'm kind of obsessed. Savannah Moss.
Wow. Okay.
Three S's on the Moss. She's nuts. I bet our listeners already know who she is.
Yeah.
Anyhow, Eddie, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
We're very excited to have a show based on a podcast that's already been endorsed on this podcast. So check it out on Peacock. Good one. A show about jokes. It's really fun. And Eddie, thanks so much for letting us into your creative process. You've just been incepted.
Thank you,
guys.
Into
the creative process of the guy that makes shows about creative processes.
Oh, man.
Yeah, we're three levels deep at this point.
I won't even be able to form sentences anymore.
If you all want to let us know about your creative process or ask us more about ours, you can email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com. You can find us across all social media at justshootitpod. I'm on Instagram at okaplan.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow across all social media. This episode was edited by Noah Bayshore and produced by him as well, with additional producing by Tyler Small. And you're listening to music provided by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.
Goodbye.
Bye.